Thanks. Welcome, everybody, and thank you for coming to Thailand from all over the world so we can share this time together. Right now, I'm going to introduce the local speaker. It's great, my great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker. It is a tradition of the roundup for Friday night speaker to be someone who is living in this part of the world. And tonight's speaker resides right here in Thailand, but he's from Australia, and he's Robert D. Please come on up and give him a warm welcome.
Hi, everybody. My name's Robert, and I'm an alcoholic. You'll excuse me if I feel a little nervous. I haven't spoken in front of this many people for a hell of a long time. And, gee whiz. I now live in Thailand, and firstly, I'd just like to say how honoured I feel to be invited to share my story with you all tonight. I promise I won't speak too long, and hopefully... I remember, you know, I had all this prepared, you know, isn't it quite amazing? And yesterday, I'm running around and had everything in three different bags, and in that were some of my notes and recollections, and what did I do? But I left everything in the back of a taxi. So I had to start all over again this afternoon. But I remember, as a young guy, I was 15, I just started work, and in fact, I started work 61 years ago yesterday, so it's quite an anniversary. I worked in a bank, and my father, who was a wonderful man, he was very good to me. I had three brothers and a sister, and people used to say I was the apple of my father's eye. He said to me one day, he said, Robert, I jumped over a 6-foot fence when you were born. So that's pretty good. And my brothers, we're all alcoholics, and unfortunately, two of them died as a result of alcohol and drugs. My youngest brother, who's now 67, he's still battling on, and that reminds me of probably one of the saddest things I've ever seen in my life. One winter's day in Sydney, I'm walking through a place called North Sydney, and I saw this guy walking up the road, and I had an overcoat on and a suit. This guy's in shorts and a shirt. And I thought, God, the poor bugger must be freezing. As he got closer, it was my brother. And it was just, you know, why did I get this and my brothers didn't? It's quite remarkable, isn't it? So I remember as a young guy, my dad used to take me on a Sunday to a hotel in Orange where I grew up. And he'd sit me on the counter. I was about 6 or 7. And I'd get a glass of lemonade. And I can remember some of his friends saying, Norm, give the young bloke a bit of beer in the lemonade. It won't hurt him. And sure enough, it didn't. I don't believe it had any effect. But that was my introduction. And then the first time I got drunk, working in this bank, and they transferred me to another small country town in New South Wales. And all the young guys, we'd all meet after work and go and drink. And I was the worst of all. My capacity for alcohol, in this room, I'd be last. There'd be no doubt about that. And I lived in a boarding house, and I was rarely home in time for dinner. And they weren't too impressed with me at all. Then I finally got to Sydney, and of course the whole wide world opened up back there, down there. A lot more things to do, a lot more people to meet. And I played a lot of tennis in those days, and we'd go out drinking. And I remember some of the guys would say, Robert, the way to improve is have some milk before we go out. Put a lining on your stomach, you'll feel better the next day, and you'll be able to drink more. Well, that didn't seem to have too much of an effect on me. Then I remember decided I'd leave the bank, and my dad was very, very unhappy because coming from the living in the Depression days, he said to me when I was accepted to work in the bank, he said, son, you've got a job for life. You're very fortunate, because his focus was always on security. And when I told him I'm leaving, he couldn't believe it. So one of the reasons I left, I wanted to do something else. And a friend of mine and I, we loved travelling, liked the idea of travelling, and we thought we'd go to the Rome Olympics. That was in 1960. So I had this car, and he said, we'll go for a drive around Australia, and then we'll earn a few dollars, and away we'll go. We got as far as Ballina, which is about 400 or 500 miles from Sydney, and we got a job as labourers working with his uncle, who was a builder. And I had to dig holes. Now, these hands had never lifted anything greater than a pen. Now, here I am with a pick and shovel, and I didn't perform too well. And I was about to get the sack, so I decided to move on. And before I did, we decided we'd have one last night out together. I remember we went into a small country town called Lismore, and both of us thought we were great drivers. So we're hurtling along. The next thing you know, because I'd had a few to drink, I finish up in hospital. I'd cut my car in half, and I was in hospital for a couple of months, almost killed myself. So that was my first introduction to doing damage to myself caused by alcohol. My mother, she was, you can imagine, seeing her eldest son in jail, wasn't terribly happy. My father, no one was happy. And she came back to Sydney, moved along, then never got to Rome, of course. Didn't get a car for a while. And I got a job with an English company. They were very staid and very strict. You called everyone sir. And I remember one day, because I used to work pretty hard. I used to love what I was doing. I said, when can I get one of those company cars that the other guys have got? I want to be a sales representative. He said, well, Robert, you go to some of the functions we have, you make a fool of yourself, you get drunk. And the car you've got now, I had a station wagon, he said, you rock in here of a Monday morning with more scratches and more dings, and you've got a mattress in the back. He said, it's not a good look. We can't possibly have someone doing that. So in my life, I have been so, so lucky. So lucky. I then met a woman, her name was Susan, and as a result of that, I straightened myself out, and I got the opportunity with the company I was working for, and they said, well, righto, well, now we'll give you a company car. So that moved along well, and I performed okay. Not very good at the marriage, because she was a nursing sister. She'd worked three jobs, because now I'm an executive. So I joined the businessman's club and I start finding poker machines. So as fast as she's earning it, I'm losing it. But I used to get enough orders to keep my job. And then they said, well, we'd like to transfer you to South Australia. And I went over there as the sales manager. And then one day, one of the sales guys said, Robert, we should go down to the Barossa Valley. The people in Australia would know where I'm referring. It's a bit like the Napa Valley for the Americans, one of our finest wine-growing areas. And I said to the guy, there's no market for our product down there. By 9 o'clock, we both knew no product and no market for the product, but there was plenty of vineyards to see. So you can imagine, I got smashed. I'm driving home, and this young man said, Robert, we've got to hurry because I've got to meet my wife at 5 o'clock. So I put the foot down, and about a minute later, the sirens of a police car chasing us. So rather than stop, Wonder Boy put his foot down further and then tried to outdistance the police. Well, I turned up a dead-end street and they were catching me, so I jumped out of my car, ran across the paddock, and a policeman tackled me. And the next thing you know, I had my first visit to jail. And I was just turned 28. Had to go to court the next day. And then there was a notice in the paper on the following day, 29-year-old sales manager pleads guilty. I was the first person in South Australia to get caught on the breathalyzer. Now, I'm not proud of that, but it's a fact. It's just something that happened. You would have thought that that would have caused me to have a closer look at what I was up to. So then the people I worked for said, well, Robert, look, you're doing a great job. We'll keep you here for a bit longer. You have to catch taxis. So I caught taxis for 3 months. And about 1 month after I got my license back, and by this time my wife's pregnant with our second child, and she said on this particular Friday, bring home the fish and chips tonight. Being a good Catholic girl, we didn't eat fish, we didn't eat steak on a Friday. So I'm driving home and I'm drunk again, of course, and I'm looking that way. Ah, there's a fish and chip shop, I said to myself, and then the car in front of me stopped. Bang. Straight up the back of him, and cut a long story short, half an hour later I'm in jail again. And I became the first person to get caught on the breathalyzer twice in South Australia. it sounds funny today, you'd reckon that I would have learned something about that, but it was not to be. The company They said, Robert, you've got enormous potential. Hey, you're good at what you do, but the alcohol, we can't give you another chance. And I was lucky they didn't give me another chance because it led me down a different path. They gave me a very nice leaving bonus and I went back to Sydney. And another wonderful thing happened. I'm walking down one of our major streets in the city one day and a guy that I'd known for many years and hadn't seen for a while said, Robert, we're looking for guys like you. I said, what do you mean? He said, we want someone that can sell. I said, I don't think I can do that. No, I want a job with security. We're just about to buy a home and the idea of working on a commission, I said, no. And anyway, he convinced me. He took me to lunch to one of Sydney's finest restaurants. I'd never been to any of these places. There's a place called the French Tavern. And this is 1969. And I'm not going to go year by year, and don't worry. We got in there. I said, gee, this is nice, Barry. He said, yeah, it's not bad, is it? I said, must be very expensive. He said, yes, but... all of a sudden, he ordered a bottle of Hensky Riesling. I remember this as if it were yesterday. And he sent it up. He said, called the waiter over. He said, give it to Peter. And Peter was the managing director of this very large insurance company. I said, oh, gee whiz. He said, Robert, you could be doing this one day. Don't worry. I said, do you really think so? I was such a naive young man. It was unbelievable. So he talked me into it. And now I'm a businessman. I've got my own business, and I said to my wife, I said, well, we're away now. I've got to go out and I've got to meet people, so don't expect me home too early. Well, I'm out and about and drinking, chasing women, and if I ever caught one, I was useless because I couldn't talk, so I never did any real damage. And then finally, she'd had enough, and she said, Robert, and she's pregnant, she said, this is no good. We can't live like this. She said, well, you need to go and see a marriage guidance counsellor. Well, I said, no, I couldn't possibly go and do that. He said, I'll leave you if you don't. So one night I came home, drunk again. It was a Friday. I used to love getting drunk on a Friday. And I walked in the front door and there was a desk, a little table about this big, and a pile of bills that high and a note. And I said, well, I'm thinking, where's all the furniture? There's no kids. There's nothing. And through my alcoholic haze, I realised they'd gone. So I had a look at the note, and it finished up by saying, I have no love left for you at all. Don't try and find me. No one would tell me where she was. It took me weeks to find out. Her mother didn't like me because she wanted her to marry a doctor. And I certainly wasn't doctor material. So I ended up sending her some money, and I finally found her. And the company I was with, the insurance company, said, Robert, you've got to do something. So when I saw this marriage guidance counsellor, this was the first time I heard about AA. She said, where's your wife? I said, I have no idea. No one will tell me where she is. She said, well, it's a bit hard for me to tell you anything or give you any advice. She said, tell me a little bit about yourself. Do you drink? I said, oh, yes, much. I said, I'd probably be drunk maybe 4 or 5 nights a week, but that's not much. She said, oh. Well, we have a doctor that you might be interested in seeing. There's a clinic for people with possible drinking problems called the Langton Clinic. So I went and sat in the park across the road from the office and I thought, could I really have a problem with alcohol? From the story I just told you, it was pretty obvious to most that I had a problem. So I went along and saw the doctor and he said, well, I'm not going to tell you whether you've got a problem, but here's a pamphlet. And I think 99% of us have seen that pamphlet. Questions such as, has alcohol cost you more than money? Has it cost you relationships, etc.? I got 9 out of 10. He said, well, it's up to you to decide. Now, my wife's gone. I'm missing her because who's going to look after me? I mean, I've always had someone looking after me. All of a sudden, I've got to cook my meals, make my bed. So, and I loved her in my funny way. And so I thought, well, I'll try this AA. So I went along to my first AA meeting on the 31st of December, 1969. Well, I went for the wrong reasons. I hadn't taken the first step. I hadn't really thought about I had much of a problem. All I wanted was for her to come back. So when I told the insurance company that I was doing this, they said, well, right, you need to get a house. So they loaned me the money straight away. I saw my wife and she said, well, okay, I'll come back. Not a difficult decision for her. She's about to have the second child. She needs someone to help her. So she had a lot of faith in me, and so did a lot of other people. About 2 weeks before she came back, I'm sitting in a beer garden in Sydney with a guy I used to do most of my drinking with. And over that time, I'd become a champion lemonade drinker, and I'd had about 15 lemonades, and it's beautiful sitting in the sun. And he said, "Rob, Sue's coming back next week. You can have a drink." I said, "You're right." "Hey, you're right. What am I doing this?" He said, "You can give that AA stuff away, going out all the time." I said, "Yeah." So anyway, she came back and she saw me having a beer. She said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Darling, it doesn't matter now. I'm a social drinker." She said, "Oh, well, that's good. That's great. That's great." So we all know what happened. And I had another addiction. I played poker machines because I thought all smart men played poker machines. Crazy, crazy man. So fortunately for me, 1972, I'm driving home and it's about 5:30 and I'm drunk and rocketing down with rain, and a little girl on the side of the road looking for a ride. So I opened the car door and said, "Please come in." And she took one look and said, "No thanks." And I pray to that woman just about every day, because I got home that night and I'd reached my rock bottom. Got home. And I said to my wife, I said, "I'm going back to AA." And that was the 9th of September, 1972. Never had a drink since. And the only time I've ever been close, for the Australians that are here tonight, they'll know what I'm referring to. Melbourne Cup Day is the first Tuesday in November. Tuesday in November is Melbourne Cup Day. So here I am with all these guys, some of them I used to drink with, and I'm hopping into the orange juice, saying nothing, and they're all giggling and laughing, having a fine time. And I thought, oh, this is no good. I'm just about to leave the group, and a friend of mine grabbed me, and he said, "Robert, get out of here. Go and play golf." And that was the last time, ever been close. And that's why, I mean, I've been so lucky. People have come into my life at various times that have just helped me enormously. So then I'm back in AA, and I met a guy called Neil, who was my first sponsor. And he used to say to me, "Robert, what you've got to do is go to meetings on a regular basis." He said, "I'll take you every night and look for the similarities and forget the differences." That was the focus. He said, "Some of the things these people have done, you may not have done, but we call those yets." And I'd heard someone say they wet the bed. And I remarked to him about that. I said, "I've never wet the bed, but not yet. Who knows? You get back out there, anything's possible." So then all of a sudden, maybe 6-9 months later, this guy, he rang me and he said, "I'm not going to AA anymore." I said, "What do you mean not going?" He said, "No, it's all bullshit." I said, I couldn't believe it. He was my sponsor and he said, "No." But fortunately for me, I didn't take any notice and I moved on. And I used to always look for the people in AA who had good sobriety, were fun to be with, and were good role models for me. So that carried on. But sometimes I thought I knew better than most and I wouldn't go to meetings on a regular basis. I might not go for a month. And I was doing very well in the business that I was now in and I wasn't really showing a lot of gratitude. One day, there was one thing I'm terribly sorry I missed to say. Shortly after, my wife came back and I'd stopped drinking in September 72. A wonderful thing happened. We went to Melbourne and my son was conceived. Now, what a great present that was and what a great gift given to both of us, because he was born in September 1973 and he's never seen his father drink. And that person is here today purely as the result of AA. So then we moved on and I went to the meeting on a Sunday night and one of my friends, and fortunately it was a guy that I knew when I was drinking, he said, "Robert, you look a bit agitated." I said, "Do I?" He said, "Yes." I said, "What's wrong?" I said, "I just smashed up the kitchen at home. I've been sober 12 years. I put my fist through a wall, yelled and screamed at the children. We had 3 by then, 4. And he said, oh, well, I'm not surprised. I said, what do you mean? Remember, this is a guy who I had respect for. He said, well, Rob, you come to these meetings on a regular basis. You don't share. You don't give anything. All you do is take. Oh, my God, this is pretty severe. And then I said, but I don't think anyone likes me. He said, well, I'm not surprised. Well, how the bloody hell could you think that, which you don't share? They don't know you. And that was part of me. That was part of my disease. I had an enormous inferiority complex. And I was always a shy guy. But AA, over the years, has helped me overcome a lot of that shyness. Now, the thought, if I go back to when I started work in 1954, if someone had told me, you'll be speaking to as many people as we have here and not stuttering too much, I would never have believed it. But so AA has been wonderful, wonderful. So then, as a result of that interference from my friend, I started to attempt to do the steps more, to focus on helping other people, attending meetings on a regular basis, and it all seemed to work. And one of the things that I used to dream about doing was travelling. Now, these are some of the gifts that I've been given. I've been able to see all parts of the world, and none of which would have happened except for two things. My wife, Susan, we're no longer married, but without her and AA, I wouldn't be here tonight. Then I remember a couple of years ago, I had a friend of mine that moved to Thailand, and he said, this is a wonderful country. You should come and have a look. And I came over 3 or 4 years ago and had a look around, and I thought, well, wouldn't be a bad place. And I've been here now just on 2 years, and I've learned so much. I've learned more about humility. I've learned more about being patient, because if you're not patient in Thailand, you've got big problems. And every morning I wake up, and I must confess, I haven't been doing this a long time, but I wake up and I say, I'm going to be a patient person today. I'm going to try to be more tolerant. I'm going to try to not be a smart ass. I'm going to try. And it's worked. And I've made some wonderful friends in the fellowship that I've learned a lot. And I'm just looking for Roger. He told me if I don't mention his name tonight, he'll shoot me. But I guess he's around there somewhere. And fellas like Bruce, he's a wonderful guy, and his mate Eric, they've all been very patient with me. And Danny from California, he's a guy I spend a lot of time with. A lot of you Americans would know him. So I've had plenty of role models. And there's a young man here tonight, Bill from Canada, who's been sober, I couldn't believe this, about 65 years. I mean, isn't that remarkable? Not many people manage that. And I remember in my early days, I met a guy. His name was Paul, and I think I'd been sober a year or two. And this fellow said he hadn't had a drink for 4 years. I said, that can't possibly be right. And God put him in my way. He made me his next-door neighbour. And he'd ring me on my early days, and he'd say, Robert, we'll go to a meeting tonight. I said, I don't think so. There's a great movie on television. And I said, it's raining. It'd be no fun. He said, Robert, believe you me, by 8:30, you'll wish you'd come. And fortunately for me, I accepted his advice. Now, I think I've touched a lot on my story, and I'd just like you to all know that I feel very honoured to have been asked to speak here tonight, and it's just wonderful to see so many of my friends, because unfortunately, I heard yesterday about one of our flock didn't make it, and that's what keeps me coming. Because one of the things that I've noticed over the years, that people who fall apart are usually, particularly if you've had long sobriety, is you stop going to meetings. You stop looking for the similarities. You forget to share. You forget all the things that we were told we should do. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.